All right, we're ready for Mark, the 8th chapter in our study. We're going to do some shifting of gears and flagging a transition point a little bit later. Between verse 30 and 31, if you haven't already done that, we'll do that here in just a little bit. This is the outline that we're following from L.A. Stopher. We're moving from the Galilean ministry to the section of from Galilee to Judea, and we'll head in that direction here in just a little bit, and that's where we'll be pointing from today forward. Anyway, under the Galilean ministry, we are ready for the confession. It seems that Mark is shooting toward this acknowledgement of who Jesus is, and perhaps the first part of chapter 8 gives us some reason why he's driving so hard at that. We'll say more about that here in a second. So we're going to finish that at chapter 8 in verse 30, and then at chapter 8 in verse 31, we begin this section of from Galilee to Judea. And we start here on the final events and teaching in Galilee as he's headed toward with his eyes set for Jerusalem and the events of Jerusalem, which are discussed in verse 31. More about that here in just a moment. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. All right, the beginning of the Galilean ministry. Chapter 2. Yeah, conflict with the Pharisees. Now that conflict is important because of some things that we're going to see in our study today. And we'll say more about that perhaps in a moment if time permits. Chapter 3. Yeah, here's that controversy. More conflict over the Sabbath here and the Sabbath healing. Chapter 4. Parables. Chapter 5. Three miracles. Chapter 6. John is beheaded. And more miracles. And then chapter 7 last time. Yeah, eating with unwashed hands and more miracles. We see even more miracles in our study today in chapter 8. So here we go. Chapter 8. What's the main point? Question 1. All right, yeah, more miracles and confession. It deals with confession and discipleship. And we'll drive at a point here in just a second. Let's get another question or two out of the way. Question number 3. Why were the Pharisees seeking a sign? All right. They're testing him. Anything else? Without using the same words, by that I mean they did not say to Jesus, "We reject the evidence you've presented." Are they not saying to Jesus when they ask for evidence that we're rejecting the evidence you've presented? Is that not the case? Yeah. For example, you're right. If someone asks you for, could you give me some evidence that baptism is essential, and you cite Mark 16, Acts 2, Acts 22, 1 Peter 3, and then they come back and say, what we're looking for, though, is evidence that baptism is essential. What does that say about what you just presented? They don't want it, or they've rejected it, and they're rejecting the miracles of Jesus. More about that here in a second. Let's make a point here and in the context, and I hope you'll see this development of thought. And several writers developed this thought, and I think this is correct concerning Mark chapter 8. This chapter seems to be driving at the dullness of the disciples, his own people. Not the Pharisees, not the Sadducees, not the Herodians. Those are mentioned. But the text seems to be, Mark seems to be painting a picture, even in the miracles that are performed here, at least one of them, the dullness of the disciples. They're slow in catching on. Does that make sense? Now let me give you some evidence of that if you hadn't caught that. In the feeding of the 4,000, remember when Jesus says, "Let's feed them," and I'm paraphrasing, the disciples raise the question, where are we going to get this food? What have they forgotten? He's already fed 5,000 men plus women and children. And so that shows their dullness. Now you might highlight or underline or flag somehow over at verse 17 that when he raises the question to them concerning the doctrine of the Pharisees. He calls it the leaven of the Pharisees. He raised the question to them, why do you reason? It's because we have no bread. And notice it, verse 17, do you not yet perceive and or understand? Is your heart still hardened? Have your eyes, having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember? Look at verse 21. How is it that you do not understand? We're not through with that. That goes further in the chapter. So watch for that concept of the focal point of the dullness of the hearing and the understanding of his own disciples. And if they had a problem grasping and remembering, finish my sentence. We might too, absolutely. We very well might too. Yeah, that's kind of the idea there. All right, let's look at verses 1 to 10, and then we're going to tie 22 to 26 with that and focus on the miracles of Jesus. Now, we try to look at the parallel accounts as they pertain to giving us some information. So for what it's worth to you, this story that we're going to look at first is found in Matthew chapter 15. It is not recorded in Luke or in John. And most of what we have is parallels in Matthew, and nothing in Luke till we get to the last section. John doesn't talk at all about our stories today. So we're not concerned with the parallel in John, at least at the moment. All right, let's talk about the miracles of Jesus recorded here. And you might want to turn over and hold a finger at Matthew chapter 15. We'll come back to that in a moment and talk about some of the things that are recorded in Matthew chapter 15 in that parallel account. Let's talk about this, where Jesus has been, first of all, before we get to Matthew chapter 15. And that is where he has been as we left off with him at Decapolis. Decapolis is down here. Remember, he'd been up at Tyre and Sidon. Remember that? And he's come down here to Decapolis. So he's on this side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, Matthew 15 in verse 30 perhaps makes it clearer than this account in Mark 7. But multitudes had followed him into the mountains. Exactly where are they at the feeding of the 4,000? We're not told. But we take it that they're on this side of the Sea of Galilee in this Decapolis, or headed up toward the northern part of Decapolis, on that eastern side of the Sea of Galilee is where this takes place. Then we're going to track his travels across to the other side of the sea, and then back across the side, and then up to Caesarea Philippi. Make sense? We're going to track all of that here in just a second. All right. So let's talk about the feeding of the 4,000. There's a multitude that have been following Jesus. They're in the mountain. And what does Jesus say? All right. Yes, he has compassion on the multitude. They've been with him for 3 days. They've come from afar, verse 3. And if he sends them back, they may faint on the way. And notice here again, we're flagging at verse 4, the disciples' lack of understanding. How can one satisfy the people with bread here in the wilderness? In other words, there's no place to buy food. We don't have it. How in the world are we going to feed the 4,000? Now remember, that's 4,000 men, and we'll flag that in a moment from Matthew 15. So Mark seems to be painting the dullness of their hearing, their dullness of understanding. Does that make sense? That they didn't get the point. They didn't get it. So he asked them, how many loaves do you have? How many did they have? Seven. And so he commanded them to sit down on the ground, and he took the seven loaves and he gave thanks and he broke it and he gave it. Now this is interesting, to the disciples to set before them, and they set it before the multitude. Reckon why he gave it to the disciples. If he's working a miracle, Jesus could have just made a food appear in front of the 4,000 or the 8,000 or however many it may be, because that, remember, that's the number of men. So however many it is that he's feeding, he could have just made food just miraculously appear in front of the people. He gave it to the disciples and told them, you go carry it to the people. They're the ones without faith, absolutely. They're the ones that's got a problem here. He's dealing as much with the disciples as he is the multitude. Does that make sense? He's focusing, seemingly, at least as Mark is painting the picture, on the dullness of the hearing of his own disciples. I'm getting that Mark 8 is pointing to us, pointing to me, as much as it is the Pharisees, seems to me. Anyway, Let's look at verse, he had them to go do that, and then there was also a few small fish. He blessed them and had them set that before them. So here's a second dose of that. Here's some fish. Let's multiply that miraculously. You take that and you distribute it. Think it ever went through the minds of the disciples that he has just taken these few fish and made it made enough fish to feed thousands. A minimum probably of 8,000. Because remember, the number that's counted is the number of men. So there's probably 8,000 been fed. That's a lot of people to be fed. Did it ever go through their mind? Well, we'll see. Then they took over fragments. How much did they have left over? Seven large baskets. How large were they? We don't know. Same word, though, by the way, is interesting, is used in Acts 9, was a basket big enough to contain a man. And so was it that big? I don't know, but it was a large basket. And so this is not seven small fragments, but they had far more left. Seven baskets, large baskets full, and that the people had not eaten. Now, those that had eaten were about 4,000, then he sent him away. Now, Matthew mentions the fact that that's 4,000 men, and that didn't count the women and children. That's just the way the Jews counted. It didn't mean the women or children were not important. That's just how they counted. All right, making sense? Now, we'll come back to verse 10 in just a second. Do you see? And so I learned something else from that. He has power over nature and over substance. So I'm seeing the power and evidence of Jesus, but I'm also seeing a painting of the dullness of the hearing of the disciples. Tracking with me? All right, let's go to verse 10. At verse 10, the text tells us that he got in a boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha. Exactly where is that? Well, you look at the parallel account in Matthew, doesn't mention Dalmanutha. It has reference to Magdala. Well, all right, let's find where that is. That's this region right here. So if I can get a, that's not what I want. Here we go. They're in this region here, and they're going to sail across over to Magdala or the region. So is this Dalmanutha? Well, it's either a region, just a region. Some suggest maybe it's two cities that are close by and that are so blended together it's hard to tell. Kind of like Dallas-Fort Worth, if you think of that. Just kind of the cities blend together. And some scholars have suggested maybe that's the case. But in that region, that's where they head. So all I'm wanting you to see is that they've gone from one side to the other side in a boat. And so they're making their way across. Now, while they're there, there's some things going to happen that we're going to skip for a moment. We're going to come back to. But just for what it's worth to you, this is a modern picture. This is from Logos Bible Software. From the east, looking toward the west side of the Sea of Galilee, that it's thought that little village that's the arrow is pointing to is the region where Jesus would have went. That's a modern picture of that for what it may be worth to us. All right. Now let's jump down to the blind man. Now this is going to take place at Bethsaida, and we'll come back to that in a moment. That's after they get through on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. They go back across to the northwestern side. We'll track that here in just a moment. But let's talk about this healing of the blind man. I think it has everything to do with the flow of the context. So when he came to Bethsaida, there was a blind man there, and the blind man was begging for what? Begging for his sight, but just for if Jesus would touch him, the text said. Did Jesus have to touch him? No, didn't have to. He could have done that at a distance. We've seen power over distance. So he took him out of the town, and he spat on his eyes and put his hands on him and asked him if he saw anything. Now, we'll talk about that progression of healing in just a moment and what that may or may not signify. But I'm interested in the fact that Jesus spat on his eyes and put his hands on him. Now, what's the significance of that? I don't know. We're not told. But it would seem, and there is some conjecture here, that he's trying to demonstrate that this miracle is coming from me. This miracle is coming from my hands. This miracle is coming from my power. Does that make sense? Rather than he just happened to be healed, Jesus is in close proximity, Maybe he had nothing to do with the Father healing him, but this power is coming from me. I spat on your eyes, I touch you, and you're healed. In fact, Jesus does two different things. All right. Now let's look at verse 24. He asked him after he had performed that miracle if he saw anything, and what was his reaction? I've seen men like trees walking. There seems to be an implication that, and again, some conjecture, but what does he know what trees look like and what men look like that would suggest to us he perhaps had seen earlier in his life? And that he knew something of what trees look like and what men look like, and how he's lost his sight, we're not told. But he doesn't have sight. He's completely blind. And then when Jesus performs the miracle, he begins to see in an unclear fashion. This is the only time this miracle is mentioned, by the way, and the only time two stages take place in a healing. So at first, he's just able to see unclear. Things are kind of fuzzy. He sees men, and they look like trees. And then what does Jesus do? Put his hands on his eyes again, made him to look up, perhaps showing where the miracle is coming from, and made him look up, and his eyes were restored, or he was restored, and he saw everything clearly. So why the two stage? The answer is that we can defend is we don't know. I can defend that. Because all I have to say is I don't know, and you know I don't know. But here's some conjecture that at least some scholars have suggested, and it may be something to it. Some suggest there may have been two different eye problems, two different maladies that was preventing his sight, and Jesus healed one and then healed the other. That one doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Some suggest that what Jesus is doing is illustrating the partial sight of the disciples. Now, that would seem to fit the context. That the disciples are not totally blind like the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians, but they're not seeing clearly either. And he may be illustrating that this man here, in the power that he's performing on the man, that this may illustrate how the disciples are not seeing clearly, but you're not totally blind, but you're not out of the woods on your sight yet. You have some growing up to do, and there's more that needs to be done until you see clearly. Is that the case? I don't know, but that would seem to fit the context. Others have suggested that he's demonstrating that the miracle and the healing came from him, like the spitting on his eyes, that he wants to demonstrate this came from me, so let me demonstrate that I healed you partially, and now I'm asking you to look up and you heal completely. Is that the case? I don't know. Questions or comments? I can't help you with your questions, but I can listen to your comments. Which one? Yeah, looking up. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes some sense. Larry? That's a good point. He didn't need to ask the question for his own knowledge. He knew he couldn't see clearly. But he wanted him to state that. And that might have been for the benefit of the disciples. I don't know. It's the only time that's recorded, to my knowledge. I know that's the only time this miracle is recorded. It's not recorded in any other, in Matthew or Luke or John. But to my knowledge, I don't remember another case where there was a partial healing and then it complete. I don't know of another one. There may be. And you find it, then I'll say I was wrong. I just don't recall that. All right, two miracles that have been performed here. So there's the healing of this blind man, and there's the feeding of the 4,000. Both give evidence of who Jesus is, but both demonstrate, I think, both demonstrate this dullness of the hearing of the disciples, dullness of their understanding. Is that making sense? All right. Now then, remember now, we left him off in this region of Magdala. That's where we left Jesus at the feeding of the 4,000. So we're going to back up in our chronology here and look at the disciples asking for a sign. Now, this is in verses 11 to 21, and the parallel account is in Matthew chapter 15, or 16 rather. So if you want to turn over there, I'm going to draw some attention to some things in Mark 16 that is not mentioned in our account here. But the Pharisees asked for a sign. Now, as they got in the boat, we'll back up just for a moment. They got in a boat, and the text tells us at verse 13 in a moment, after Jesus has some discussion with them, and they're going to be heading back across the sea from here up toward Bethsaida. Now, there's two Bethsaidas, and we take it to be this one and not the one over here close to Capernaum, because they're going to head up to Caesarea Philippi in a minute. Make sense? That's why we think that. All right? So let's go back now to our outline and follow the Pharisees asking for a sign. Now, the Pharisees came and they began to dispute with him, seeking a sign from him, and they were testing him. What was Jesus' reaction to that? Yeah, he sighed deeply in his spirit. In other words, he's frustrated with them. And he said, why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. Well, he'd already told them earlier. I don't mean earlier as in Matthew's account, but earlier in his ministry, he'd already told them no sign would be given but that of the prophet Jonah. What is that sign? Yes, and he mentions that again in Matthew's account. Now, let's make a couple of connections here in Matthew 16 to fill us in about some things that took place that Mark doesn't record. Remember, Mark is this fast-paced writer that he's just hitting it and running, and so he doesn't take time to give the details that Matthew does. So let's go to Matthew 16 just for a moment. They ask, for they come seeking a sign from him, and this is the occasion. Already, number one, already he's given signs. He's worked miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle, and so abundant signs have been given. So to deny them saying, I'm not going to give another sign, it's like, again, you cited four passages and they rejected them. You don't need another one. And another one's not going to mean anything to you, so I'm not going to give you another one. It's not a rejection of giving evidence. But Matthew shows that he rebuked them for not being able to see the evidence. Look at verses, and I'm not going to take the time to read it, at verse 2, 3, and 4, that you can look to the sky and determine what the weather's going to be. In other words, there's not a sign written in heaven that says it's going to rain today, but you can look at the cloud and say, you know what, it's going to rain. Or you can look at there's no clouds, and you can say, we're going to have good weather. And you can discern the signs of the sky, and you can't discern the signs of the time, meaning you ought to be able to reason and infer and draw conclusions from the evidence that's been presented. He rebuked them for that. But another thing that he mentions at verse 4, Matthew 16, is this is an evil and adulterous generation and there's no sign going to be given. In other words, I don't need to give any more. The ultimate sign is going to be the resurrection. Making sense? Mark didn't tell us about all of that, and that's just something that Matthew includes for us. All right. Now let's turn to verse 13, and he warns about the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and of Herod. Mark is the only one mentions Herod, and we'll get to that here in a second. So we're going to add some information to that in a moment. So they departed and went to the other side. So let's go back to our map here for what it's worth. Let's see, do we have another map here? Nope. Let's go back. So he's departing, and he's headed over to Bethsaida. How do I know Bethsaida? That's where this blind man was healed. Remember that? Now, chronologically, we hadn't got there yet. We've already studied the text, but we hadn't got there yet. So they're headed on to the other side, means they're headed over here on that side of the sea. So anyway, they head over there, and they get in a boat, and Jesus warns them. Now, they had forgotten to take bread with them. They only had one loaf of bread. And Jesus said, look at verse 15, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Now, for what it's worth, Mark never takes the time or the space to explain what he means by leaven. Matthew does. Matthew says that he was talking about the teaching or the doctrine. So that's Matthew 15 or 16 and in verse 12. He's talking about their teaching. That's what he meant by that. And so the point is, the teaching that is false has a permeating and a leavening effect. It's the danger of false doctrine. And we need to be aware of that. So what's the big deal? Brother so-and-so's teaching error. It has a leavening effect. Now here's part of their dullness. They reasoned it was because they didn't have any bread. More demonstration of their dullness. Let's finish the flow of that context, and then I want to come back and talk about Herod at verse 15. So notice again this evidence of dullness. Why do you reason? Now, he knew they were thinking. He knew what they were thinking. So why are you thinking that it's because you didn't bring bread? He's focusing on their dullness. What else do you see? Verse 17, 18 through verse 21. Of his rebuke of their dullness of hearing, dullness of understanding. Yeah. Look at verse 18, having eyes, do you not see? In other words, do you not use your eyes? Can you not see? Do you have ears and do you not use them? Do you not remember the 5,000? Do you not remember the 4,000? Do you not remember all the other miracles? How many fragments did we take up? Do you not? Oh yeah, they remember. They just didn't draw the conclusion. They didn't get the connection. And then he said, how is it that you do not understand? What does that question mean? Verse 21. How is it that you do not understand? Good point. I want to come back to that. Diana said their mind is on physical things and not on spiritual things. They're not grasping. We're not through with that concept. Peter's going to be rebuked on that here in just a moment. We'll get to that as time permits. How is it that you don't understand? Let's go back and talk about Herod just for a moment. What is he talking about when he talks about the doctrine of the Pharisees, Matthew says, and Sadducees, but Mark's account says Pharisees and Herod? Some have concluded Herod was a Sadducee. I don't think so. Because in Mark 6, he concluded that when he heard about John, about Jesus, this is John raised from the dead. Sadducees didn't believe that. It's not saying that he was a Sadducee at all. I don't think that at all. I think as we look at the parallel accounts of the doctrine of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the Herodians. Now, is he talking about Herod? Some think he's focusing on the political leadership of Herod and that his political doctrine is, we often talk about the positions of a leader, you might talk about the Eisenhower doctrine or the Trump doctrine, or we don't talk about that as much as you did in Eisenhower's day, but you talk about a president's doctrine. It wasn't his teaching, but it's his position on foreign policy, whatever it may be. Does that make sense? Some think he's talking about Herod himself. I don't think so. I think he's talking about the Herodians, and here's why. Look at chapter 3 and in verse 6. The Herodians, who were seemingly an odd connection with the Pharisees, they didn't get along too well with the Pharisees, but often enemies will bond together when they have a common enemy. So look at chapter 3, Mark 3 and in verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians. Now who were the Herodians? The Herodians were supporters of Herod. The Pharisees weren't supporters of Herod, nor were the Sadducees supporters of Herod, but the Herodians were. That was a sect of the Jews, but they all had a common bond. They hated Jesus. Does that make sense? Let me give you a couple of other references. Mark 12 and in verse 13, we see the Herodians mentioned again. So I think he's just talking about any sect of the Jews that are rejecting. Be aware of the doctrine these sects, whether it's the Pharisees, the Sadducees, they didn't get along, and they didn't get along with the Herodians, but they all get along together as they fight against Jesus. And so be aware of the doctrine of those. All right, now he comes to Bethsaida, and that's where we have the healing of this man that we just talked about. All right, now let's drive to verses 27 to 38, and that finishes the chapter. The question is, who is Jesus and what does it mean? That's what they've missed. The dullness of the disciples have missed that point. And so now we're ready to ask the question. So Jesus asked the question, and where does this take place? Well, this is taking place. Now, the parallel accounts, we won't mention much about Luke, except Luke mentions the crowd instead of men. That's the only thing Luke adds for us. Matthew does add some information that we'll flag here in just a moment. But we have them here at Bethsaida, and this discussion takes place in the region of Caesarea Philippi, in the cities of Caesarea Philippi. So that's where they are now. Does that make sense? All right, let's see what happens here. Jesus comes to his disciples and he asks them, who do men, Luke says, the crowd, say that I am? What was the answers? All right. Remember in Mark 6, Herod was credited with saying this is John the Baptist. Maybe he started a rumor, I don't know. Why would they think he's Elijah? All right, Elijah was taken up, and the Jews thought he was coming again. And then there was also prophecy of one coming in the spirit and the power of Elijah, and some took that Elijah was returning. So they're looking for Elijah. And so here's this rumor about John the Baptist, or one of the prophets, probably Jeremiah. And you say, why Jeremiah? The Jews thought Jeremiah was coming back. And so we're looking for Jeremiah to come, we're looking for Elijah to come. And there's this rumor started, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. These are some of the things that men are saying. But who do you say that I am? And Peter, the first to speak up, said, you are the Christ. You are the Christ of God, Luke's account. Matthew's account, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Matthew's a little more thorough. Now then, I'm interested in a couple of things. At verse 29, you might flag to the side. It's at this point Matthew talks about, Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church, upon that confession. Mark doesn't mention that at all. All right. Now let's look at verse 30. This has caused a lot of question. This is not uncommon already in our study of Mark, but this one particularly charging the disciples, not somebody that has been, a miracle has been performed on, but charging the disciples. And the word charge here means he strictly warned them. It's a very strong word. He strictly charged them that they should tell no one about him. Why? Some conjecture there. I'm not sure why. There's one sect of the people who have accepted him, thinking that he's powerful, and they're ready to seize him and make him king. Remember John 6. We don't get to that to John 6 in verse 15. There were others who were watching him, like the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees, ready to kill him. But probably in this context, the point seems to be that the disciples have got some growing up to do. They've got some maturing to do. You're not ready to go out and tell this message. So I think really two things. One is they're not ready, and secondly, this is going to be better accepted and understood after his death and resurrection. Once he's raised from the dead and the evidence of the empty tomb is there, this is going to go much better. Does that make sense? You're not ready now, and there's a major event coming that they don't understand is going to happen that's going to be far better. Make this better. So don't go out telling that I'm the Christ, the Son of the living God, just yet. The time is going to be right and ready for that later. All right, now let's get ready to mark a transition point. Between verse 30 and 31 is a transition point. How so? We're shifting from his focus. Up to this point, his focus has been in Galilee and preaching in Galilee. From this point on, his focus is on Jerusalem and the events of Jerusalem. And he starts that at verse 31. We made that transition point. If you want to turn back to Matthew 16, 21, you probably have a note there about a transition point. That takes place between 30 and 31. From this point on, we're focused on Jerusalem. And he's not there yet. He's still in Galilee. He's going to do some teaching, but he's headed there. Make sense? Transition and focus. So let's see what the focus is. See if we can get through with these eight verses here. He began to teach the disciples, beginning at verse 31, he tells them of his death and of his resurrection. This may be an explanation of verse 30, just a moment ago. He's going to go to Jerusalem, and I ask a question. I forgot what number it is. You can find it there. What four things are said about Christ? What are they? All right. Yes, very good. Verse 31, that was question number six. He's going to suffer many things, rejection, crucifixion, etc., be rejected, number two, killed, and rise the third day. Do you think the disciples grasped that? No, not yet. And he spoke the word openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Might make a marginal note. Peter is thinking about Peter. Peter is not denying himself. Evidence? Jesus tells him he needs to deny himself in a moment. Peter is not denying himself. So he turned around and looked at his disciples and he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get you behind me, Satan." In other words, Satan is behind what's going on. "You are not mindful," might underline this, "mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." You're not thinking about the things of God, nor were the other disciples for that matter. That's the context. Been trying to paint that picture all morning. But you're thinking about the things of men, not the things of God. Now what's interesting, Matthew's account, verse 23, 16, 23, Peter, or Jesus told Peter that you are a hindrance to me, the English Standard. You're not helping me, New Century. Peter, you're doing the work of Satan by telling me it's not going to happen. You're rebuking me. You're no help to me. You're a hindrance to me. And so here's what needs to be done. Might underline, back at verse, we did this in Matthew, so let's do it again, except our points are going to be a little different. Mindful of the things of God, you're not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. So let's talk about this being mindful of the things of God. What's involved in that? Well, verse 34, remember the four things? In answer to question number five, I believe it's five, or seven, no, it's seven. The four things are to come after me, deny yourself, the thing Peter was not doing, and take up your cross and follow me. So here's a good question. Are you mindful of the things of God? Well, if you want to be mindful of the things of God, come after Christ, deny yourself, take up your cross, follow him, and then there's the value of the spiritual over the physical life. Look at verse 35. If you desire to save your life, you'll lose it. Whoever desires to, who loses his life for my sake will, and the gospels will save it. There's the value of the spiritual life over the physical life. And then verse 36 to 38, to finish the chapter, there's the value of the eternal over the temporal. What profit the man if he gains the whole world, loses his own soul? What man give in exchange for his soul? Does that make sense? And what I hope you walk away with this morning concerning the dullness of the disciples is that here is the description Jesus just gave. Here's the problem that Mark's been trying to paint for us. They're mindful of the things of men, not of the things of God. Does that make sense? I don't know of a chapter that describes better the dullness of the hearing of the disciples than Mark 8. If you know of one, flag that for us and we'll take a look. But I don't know of one that does it better. Maybe equal, but not better. Making sense? Last question, number whatever it is, nine. Practical things you've learned from this chapter.
But I think it's interesting what we're studying next is God told Moses, Moses, I'm already told God, we forget, or we just don't pay attention and we don't learn.
Absolutely. If these, good point, good point. If these disciples could be slow of hearing and slow of understanding and didn't get it, that might be me too. Yeah. Another practical thing. Something you take home with you. Say, I got this from this chapter. There's no need for further evidence when evidence has already been given. Jesus is not saying I won't give evidence. What he's saying is, I gave you evidence, you rejected it. You're going to reject anything else I give you. There's no need. No need. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. can have a big impact. Yeah. Don't blindly follow religious leaders or political leaders. Good point. Absolutely. We're done.